You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello! What a difference one game can make in a weekend.
So we had been preparing to do a post-Seattle sports weekend podcast.
Sadcast.
Yeah,
not a podcast.
Sadcast was what we were planning for. And then in one game, in one goal line sequence, it all changed.
I was so prepared to talk to you about what I could pay attention to now, right? Because I had to focus all my energy onto sports from last week, right?
Yep.
And then sports, what I thought was going to fail me. So
I was prepared
to ask you the question, what can I focus on now? Bird watching, right? Apiary.
I was going to suggest you'd have women's basketball off to a 1-0 start.
That's still sports, though.
Yeah, but they're a safer space.
Moon gazing, is that an activity? in Seattle.
I would not recommend that in Seattle in the wintertime.
But then everything changed, and it is the wintertime. And we've got just a quick little beer. We don't need to talk too much about it, but we have to have a celebratory toast, right?
We do.
And we have with us from Seattle, Washington, a Fremont Bonfire Winter Ale.
So I had this a couple weeks ago, and it was delicious. So I'm excited to have it again.
When you told me about that earlier, when I purchased the Bonfire Winter Ale, you gloated about who you had it with.
We're not going to talk about that on the podcast.
Not willing to talk about it.
I'm not dropping those names.
Wow. You know who they are, though. You out there know who they are.
Some of them may or may not be listening to the podcast. Then they would probably know, hopefully. We didn't have that much bonfire. We certainly did not. So I almost don't even know where to begin at this point with everything that transpired.
You should start with letting me pour this first. Let's begin there.
That was my attempt to fill, though.
I like it. That's a good fill.
As you fill these glasses, I was trying to fill.
Well, I really think...
Do we begin at the end?
I think we should start at the end, right?
The toast.
There we go.
Actually, a toast to defending every blade of grass.
Yes. And I think that's where we should start, right? Let's work our way backwards. And start with that last drive. Let's start with the Seahawks score a touchdown, pass to Doug Baldwin. We're very excited, jumping up and down. Seahawks are going to go up 8, right?
Yes.
Or are they?
Yes. Instead, they decide to go for 2. And a controversial decision on Twitter. I think I saw some people that I like and respect who said they, quote, hated the call.
Really?
Yeah.
Hated the call?
They did.
I'm surprised by that.
Which... the math basically says, what you're doing is, by going up 9, you're forcing New England to score twice.
Yes.
Otherwise, you're at the mercy of them having to convert a 2-point conversion. Generally speaking, my understanding of the math is, if you feel your chances of converting the 2-point conversion are better than your chances of stopping the 2-point conversion, you should go for it.
Yes.
And since, in general, 2-point conversions are converted about half the time, it's basically like your discretion. I felt more comfortable with the Seahawks offense deciding the game than their defense.
Well, and also,
I was obviously wrong about that, by the way.
When you imagine a play that we were imagining and happen at the end of the game,
it's true.
Which is Gronk one-on-one outside. I told you, he catches that. Let's say that they come down, score a touchdown. What? Their 2-point conversion is Gronk one-on-one.
I mean, I think Chris Collinsworth said it. This was actually before the 12 men on the field penalty on the Seahawks moved the ball from the 2 to the 1 for that play. But he said, basically, this is your best 2-point conversion play.
Yes.
Yeah. And so we saw it.
And it was clearly, and I said that if they get Gronk one-on-one to the outside, 100 times out of 100, he's going to get it.
Yeah.
I said, you could have taken the percentage chances of that happening, run the simulation live, and it would have been 100%.
It turns out this is the zeroth time out of 100. That zero time.
And thank God that Cam Chancellor is back, right?
Yes, because this was a huge game for him to be back.
Only one player. A toast to Cam, right? I mean, you just feel the defense.
Let me tell you, it was a rough night for the fans who were tweeting Bob Condotta about how the Seahawks need to trade or release Cam Chancellor this offseason. Like, look, I get the cap ramifications, everything, but in the event that Cam Chancellor is not here next season, that's like... a grudgingly will have to do this, not a, hey, let's get rid of Cam. Kelsey McCray is just as good.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not. Nobody is saying people with that Kelsey McCray is just as good hot take are not coming out of the woodworks right now.
They are not. Kelsey McCray is fine. I was actually a little surprised that we didn't see him on the field. I don't recall seeing him on a defensive sequence. Instead, we saw Stephen Terrell in the time package.
In the dime, yeah.
Yeah.
But having Cam back there just gives you such a different element, right?
Especially against a guy like Gronk.
I mean, you have the huge fumble that he forced, right?
The other fumble he almost forced.
The other fumble he almost forced. The hit on Gronk was Earl, right?
Yes.
And then also defending the Patriots' best player, a weapon that no team in the NFL has, right? He is defending the greatest weapon in the entire NFL on one play, on a one-on-one play, and Cam Chancellor's back there. If Kelsey McCray would have been there, I don't think we're talking about the same situation.
No, I certainly would not feel as comfortable with it.
Do you have any thoughts on the call on the play?
The no call?
The no call.
Yeah, I think it was probably justice was done.
We both saw an OPI live.
Well, there was a tweet from Football Zebra at Football Zebras, and you know, not that this is a definitive thing or anything, but
I take everything that at Football Zebra says is definitive.
Double engagement, neither side gets an advantage. Marginally was OPI. Good no call.
Yeah, I mean Gronk especially wants the pass first.
Like that's probably one of those situations where like you wait to see the outcome of the play. Like if they complete the pass, then maybe you call OPI. Since they didn't complete it, there's no need to call anything. Yeah. But there was certainly 5 seconds of sheer terror as we waited to see the flag come out for that one.
Yes. Gronk hits Cam Chancellor first, though, right?
He starts engaging.
Yes. So I think NBC dwelled on it maybe a little bit more than they should have just to create a story at the end of the game. And because it's a Seahawks game and the last play needs to have some sort of drama. I mean, there's enough drama unto itself.
I mean, scriptwriters are doing an amazing job with these Seahawks games.
They really are.
And the way they set this up with the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that was amazing.
That's the long game here. With New England getting the ball, second and goal at the one.
Okay, so I wanted to look at... I was just looking at the breakdown of the stats for this game, and it is insane, right? We were talking about that Arizona game a couple weeks ago that ended in a tie, right? Was
yes.
this before we had a podcast? I think it might have been before we had a podcast.
I think we may have talked about, like, the aftermath of it was our first episode.
Okay. But that was one of those games where you felt like, you know, both teams played really hard, but maybe neither team deserved to win, right?
I don't quite buy that, but sure.
And this is one of those games where you're like, man, I'm so happy that we won. But even had the Seahawks lost, it felt like both of these teams are clearly two of maybe the three or four best teams in the league, right? And playing such a high level, especially offensively.
Like above and beyond what this means in terms of solidifying the Seahawks' chances at a top two seed in the NFC and a bye in the first round of the playoffs, just... you feel good about the way they're playing.
Yes.
Like when the offense is playing like this, when the defense gets Michael Bennett back, that's a combination that we've seen in the past and has been very successful.
So I wanted to look at the breakdown stats wise, right? Or
okay.
Total offense, Seahawks 420, Patriots 385, right?
Yeah.
Washington State had to get 420 in there. But then you look at yards per play, 6.4 to 6.2, right?
Yep.
Such a small advantage. Time on the field.
30-25 to 29-35.
Basically exactly the same amount of time on the field.
A welcome change of pace from recent Seahawks games.
I mean, it is amazing. The only thing that is really different, and honestly, it made a huge difference in the game, but when you look at it like this, the only thing that's really, you can see a difference is turnovers, right? The Patriots had those two big turnovers. The Seahawks could have had some, which might have been deadly and definitely helped. It could have been, basically the turnovers meant that it could have been the Seahawks who were at the other end scoring, right? Let's say that fumble doesn't happen with Edelman, and then it's the Seahawks there on that fourth down
pressure to score. Yeah.
So I think it just flipped who the team was at the end of the game, but almost two entirely evenly matched teams, which is pretty amazing to watch.
You know, as we look long term from this game, I think the one thing that probably stands out more than anything to me is the emergence of CJ Procise.
Oh yeah.
17 carries for 66 yards to 5 carries for Christian Michael, but then more importantly, 7 catches on 7 targets for 87 yards.
And we don't have the individual carries log yet. That'll come out later with Pro Football Reference, right? But I'm very curious to see. It felt like CJ Procise, first off, there were holes for him to run through.
Yeah.
Second off, he was finding holes to run through. Third off, if there wasn't a hole to run through, he was getting 2-3 yards, which is so huge in this offense, right?
Yeah.
Getting something and not getting stuffed has been so huge for the Seahawks. And it feels like CJ Procise, even if there's contact, it's something that we always talked about Marshawn, right? He never fell backwards.
Here's the thing. The Patriots in this game did not have a rush tackle for a loss.
Came close, and Kristen Michael actually had to break some tackles to get there.
Yeah, they had three tackles for loss. Those were all their sacks.
So I think bringing a very different element, and the amount of negative plays that the Seahawks had was so much lower, and it meant that we'd seen in this in so many games where the negative plays are derailing offense, right?
Yeah.
And in this game, basically every drive, and on every scoring drive, nothing hugely negative.
Right? Also, relatively few penalties in this game.
Yes.
Yeah.
I thought the line in general, I mean, there were times that Russell was under pressure, but I thought played a really good game. And it seems like maybe this is the group. It seems like maybe they found the group that works together.
Well, even though we saw Jamarcus Webb late in the game.
Who was he playing for?
I think for Gary Gilliam.
Okay. But it's George Fant at left tackle, right? I mean, people keep talking about Sewell potentially coming back, but it's like, this is George Fant's job.
I mean, Pete Carroll is also one of those people who's talking about Sewell coming back. So let's not go too far with this. But yes, I think that they are better off sticking with Fant at this point.
And you could see some of the time where he was blocking, pushing his defender to the outside. Now, granted, we talked about this earlier on last week's podcast. This is not an amazing Patriots defense. We predicted, I told you, there would be points scored in this game.
Yeah, I mean, I think you saw this game pretty clearly. Did you talk about this coming down to the final drive?
I mean, we knew it would come down to the... It's a Seahawks obviously. Game.
Yeah.
Like, you could predict that about any Seahawks game and be right. I can make a prediction for week 15 or whatever, right? When they play the Rams or the Cardinals in week 15, I think it's going to come down to the final drive. Any game, you could predict that. But George Fant pushing his defender to the outside and giving Russell a lane to come through to open up passing lanes, right?
Yeah.
And then when stuff breaks down, it was something that we didn't see in the Husky game that we'll talk about in a second. But when stuff breaks down, Russell was able to find open receivers almost every single play in what was, I think, probably Russell's best game of the year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think unquestionable. I mean, he looks so much healthier that mobility allows him to extend plays. And the Seahawks receivers are great at making plays in those situations. Just, you know, improvising out there with Wilson and being on the same page with him, and you very rarely see mistakes in those situations.
Yeah, the one I was looking at the catches and targets, Procise, 7 targets, 7 catches, right?
I did say that earlier.
And a lot of that stuff was just finding him out of the backfield where they're like, okay, CJ Procise probably is not a great blocker at this point. Chris Collinsworth mentioned that on the broadcast. Probably not a great blocker at this point, right?
Yes.
But if you let him shoot out, that is an element. It's something that the Patriots do so well too, right? It's something that they've done with various different running backs for years. I was also thinking with Deion Lewis coming back that he was not going to be a factor, and he really wasn't even at all.
I don't think he saw the field. Was he even active?
I definitely didn't play. But then you look at the catches. Doug Baldwin, 8 targets, 6 catches. Jimmy Graham, 4 targets, 4 catches. Curse was the one who actually...
Yeah, let's not talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. This is the happy part of the podcast. We're not talking about Jermaine Curse's
game. But another thing that Russell did that we haven't really seen that much of this year, and it's my favorite Russell thing, right, is when Russell is scrambling, it looks like he's about to go out of bounds. He throws it. You're like, is he throwing it away or is he throwing it to a receiver? And all of a sudden, it's a first down.
Yeah, Jimmy Graham just appears at the sticks.
That is the – and I think there was a huge Lockett catch like that also.
Yeah.
Where somebody's sliding in, you're like, oh, Russell. That is my favorite Russell play.
It's just good to have peak Russell back in our lives.
It is amazing how huge of a difference. I think I said this at the beginning. It is amazing how big of a difference this win can make on the whole weekend, especially capping it last game of the weekend.
Right.
Pulling together the most important football weekend in Seattle sports history.
But not. As we discovered on Twitter after the fact that at one point in the last weekend of 1984, start of 1985, the Seahawks played at Miami in the playoffs, and the Huskies played in the Orange Bowl against number 2 Oklahoma the same week.
Okay, how about this? The most important Seattle sports weekend in my lifetime.
There you go. Not in my lifetime. I don't really remember that week very well from age 2, but I was alive.
It was shortly before I was born. Okay, so obvious plays stood out, right? Were there any plays that stood out to you as being crucial that didn't get the same kind of attention as the Cam Chancellor fumble or something like that?
Well, I mean, I think... The entire sequence at the end. I mean, also, you know, getting the touch, the last drive at the end of the first half.
That's I was going to say. That is what really brought this whole game together. And it's something it felt like, feels like the Seahawks haven't done this season. They've had good drives at the end of the first, because the same game happens. The Seahawks play the same game every week, right? They're always going to get the ball at the end of the first half with a chance to score. Sometimes they get a field goal, sometimes they get nothing.
I feel like this year the 2-minute drills have not been as strong.
But having that 2-minute drill, getting the ball with just a little over a minute left and scoring a touchdown there was so huge.
Yeah, because it meant that you stayed basically ahead other than that one drive where New England scores to go up 21-19 and the Seahawks eventually answer with a field goal. I guess they were ahead two times, but they were never ahead more than a field
goal.
There
were 7 lead changes or something.
Yeah, there were.
Something. And there were times that they were ahead. But that drive to me was the drive that the Seahawks haven't necessarily made this entire season, and something they did in the Super Bowl, if you recall correctly.
Chris Collinsworth mentioned that.
But
Chris Collinsworth's very good.
I don't know if I agree with that. But he had a very nice sweater on. I felt like, you know, if he was reading to me by fireside, I think it'd be very comforting.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But that drive in particular was a drive that it was a very Seahawks drive of days of yore, but something that they haven't necessarily done this year and executed it so perfectly where you just feel really good about it.
Nope.
And the other thing that I wanted to mention is just the every blade of grass, right?
Yes.
Which... This game in particular reminds us that nothing has happened until it's happened, right?
Wait, just this game? Well, not the Arizona game?
Every game.
Not this entire season?
But we are talking inches here, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you look at some of those plays.
Again, we were in the Arizona game. They almost scored a touchdown, remember?
Oh, yeah. No, huge. Yeah. All of a sudden, I'm kind of questioning, like, okay, why is Pete challenging the CJ Prosize play? We'll just get it on the next play. And boom, boom, they don't get it. There's a false start, and then they have to kick a field goal, right? There's no getting it on the next play. The Patriots, on the other hand, you're like, okay, let's just give them a touchdown, bring it back the other way.
Yes.
But then they stuff LeGarrette Blount. Brady fumbles it, right?
No, they stuff the Brady sneak first.
Oh, well, that was a longer sneak from, yeah, like the two. So they stuff the Brady sneak, stuff LeGarrette Blount, then Brady fumbles it, right? Which is a huge play. And then it sets up the one last play so that every blade of grass, you just don't let them in. Nothing is determined until it happens.
I mean, it's not just a motto at this point because, you know, that's just something you say. This is a philosophy. It is a way of life for the Seahawks defense. And you see why the coaching staff preaches it in the results of these close games and where, you know, these tiny margins end up meaning so much to the game.
Yeah, every game. They're all the same.
Really remarkable, though, so many things. Because I will say, the one thing that where Russell Wilson is not quite perfect as a quarterback, I have always felt, is that he can't sneak at all. I don't even remember the last time the Seahawks have sneaked.
Very bad sneaker.
And so I've always been envious of Tom Brady's ability to sneak. So to stop him twice...
Yes.
On sneaks to win the game is pretty amazing. Not that the Seahawks necessarily stopped on the second time.
Don't forget that Russell snuck the ball twice to seal the game.
He did. That's true. Because the game was not over when they took over the ball.
Yeah, like, the game is not
that
over.
That was still a very dicey situation. I had a premature had it all the way tweet before that. And then I saw where we were having to kneel and I was immediately overcome with terror.
How amazing was that Ed Hockley call from that Rams game like 10 years ago?
It really was great.
The game is not over. Just maintains forever.
I feel like if we were going to start a Seahawks blog, we already have a podcast, so probably would have to be somehow separate with that. The game is not over would be a pretty good name for
that blog.
That's
pretty good, right? Yeah. Who was kicking that field goal? Wasn't that Josh Brown? Maybe on the Rams? Josh Brown was involved one way or another.
I think it must have been Josh Brown. But the Seahawks had the ball.
Yes.
They were called for a false start.
Yes.
So they were trying to kick the field goal.
Yeah, and I think it was Josh Brown.
It seems reasonable.
Before he went to the Rams.
And before so many other things happened.
Yeah.
We'll not get into those now.
Did anybody stand out to you that, besides, obviously, Doug Baldwin and Russell Wilson and Cam Chancellor?
I mean, I think Tyler Lockett looks like himself the last couple weeks. And that's as much, along with Russell Wilson looking like himself, another factor in the offense getting going. Lockett, 3 catches for 72 yards, and then also a big kickoff return at one point in this game, and then the Patriots were concerned enough about kicking to him that they ended up kicking the ball out of the bounds, and the Seahawks get it at the 40 on one drive. You asked a question. Did you have any answer?
Aside from him, also, I think Frank Clark starting to maybe a little bit become kind of a Michael Bennett type. I think he's learning a lot from Michael Bennett and Cliff Averill. Frank Clark's starting to be able to do some things at multiple positions on the D-line. I thought Ataba Rubin, he had that tipped pass going to Gronk, getting some pressure, seeing the big men get a sack, right?
Jaron Reed?
Yeah, Jaron Reed and Ataba Rubin getting a sack was pretty huge. Thought they disrupted things. And then you also mentioned Brock Coyle.
Yeah, had a very solid game. Didn't play a ton out there. They obviously were playing a lot of nickel, but that was a matchup I was concerned about, having him out there against the likes of Martellus Bennett and Gronk. But he more than held his own, and we didn't, I don't think, see Kevin Pierre-Lewis on defense at all in this game before he left with an injury. So
feeling good.
Absolutely.
Right. Do we have any other thoughts on the Seahawks?
I mean, you're sitting 6-2-1. The schedule is pretty favorable the rest of the way. This was clearly the most difficult game left on the schedule entering this point. The way the rest of the NFC fell today was great for the Seahawks, because the teams that won, other than Dallas, who is looking like they're going to run away with the one seed, the teams that won were Washington and Philadelphia, two teams who are probably not going to win their division because they've got Dallas in it. So their record vis-a-vis the Seahawks doesn't really matter. It's the record of, you know, the NFC North winner and the NFC South winner that you're really concerned about. And both of those potential teams lost today.
Yes. It was a rough day for the NFC, except for the Seahawks. Seahawks and the Cowboys.
Yeah.
Yes. It was a rough day for the NFC, except at the top, right?
Yeah.
And the playoff odds are only going to get better from here.
So that's certainly exciting.
All right. So we felt good, right?
We've had a lot of positivity here.
We've been feeling really good. We're happy. Everything's great. But also, we have to look back just 24 hours to how we were feeling yesterday.
Well, here's the thing. I'm rationalizing this UW loss hard.
I even woke up. There's probably not been a loss. I mean, we haven't been in the situation, so I don't really know how to react, right? But, I mean, the Huskies haven't been in the situation since 2001.
2000. Yeah, the loss at Oregon.
But I don't really know how to react to it. But also, I woke up feeling kind of okay.
I mean, first off, the fact that Clemson and Michigan also lose,
yes,
and the college football playoff is just in complete chaos now. Like, if the Huskies win out, their chances, I still feel, are pretty good of making the playoff.
Really?
Obviously, the committee has been down on their schedule. That's obviously an issue. And the fact that they lost the hardest game to date does not help that case.
Yeah.
But you look at, there's four teams from the Pac-12 in the top 15.
That seems about right.
Am I remembering that right? Something like that, maybe.
Yes. And I mean, of the AP rankings, there are four teams from the Pac-12.
That's right, because we obviously haven't seen the college, yes, football playoff rankings will come out.
Including Wazoo at 20, so five teams in the top 20.
Yeah, and the Huskies, I don't know, I keep calling the Seahawks. The Huskies will be playing one of those teams in Wazoo in 2 weeks, and if they win that game and do get to the Pac-12 championship, you're going to get either another crack at USC or Colorado, or in a long shot, Utah. One of those, whoever those teams ends up winning out, is going to probably be at the fringes of the top 10, yeah, I think, by that point.
And could be playing Wazoo, who could have just beaten Colorado also.
Yeah.
Could be playing Wazoo, which
would help their case,
Colorado,
yeah,
victory. Yeah, I mean, we feel good from that aspect, right?
Yeah.
But the aspect that we feel bad from is the Joe Mathis being out for the year aspect, and then not having any pass rush whatsoever aspect.
So we talked about this. The Huskies pass sack rate since Mathis had gone out was far worse than any Pac-12 team has managed over the course of the season. And then it played out completely during this game, where the Huskies had just one sack and got very little pressure whatsoever on Sam Darnold, who was able to do almost anything he wanted.
Yep, pretty much. I mean, that lack of pass rush, they started bringing a little bit more blitzes in the second half, right? Started blitzing a little bit more in the second half and got some pressure occasionally. Ended up with the one sack from, I think, Connor Jones. But
Connor O'Brien.
Connor, what's his name?
O'Brien.
Connor O'Brien. He should change his name to Connor Jones.
Sure.
But also, that meant that there were more receivers open.
Yes.
Right?
It increased the threat of the big play.
Sam Darnold is just really good.
He is. I've tried to say it on this podcast.
Man, I think Sam Darnold might be someday a top 5 pick, but
he probably still exceeded our expectations. And I think what we didn't foresee was UW having such a difficult time moving the ball against USC's defense.
And It was windy. It was kind of gross out. But man, this is Jake Browning's crappy day.
Yeah. I mean, first off, that's the kind of weather that should benefit UW against USC.
It doesn't make any sense. I mean, it doesn't because it shouldn't benefit. They passed the ball well, though. I don't know. I really don't know what to tell you.
I mean,
it was just a bad day.
What stood out is what we were just talking about with Russell Wilson and the ability to be on the same page of is his receivers when he improvises. That wasn't there for UW at all.
Amazing how their defenders. So we sit in the end zone, right? We sit in the last row of the end zone. So we're able to see when players are open, right?
Yep.
We're able to see who's open and who's not, especially side to side, pretty well.
Yep.
And on broken down plays, Jake did the best he could do to get into space, right?
Which there were a lot of those, for the record.
Jake didn't do badly in that aspect, but then couldn't find anybody open. It's not like we're looking downfield and being like, oh, that dude's open. He's open. He's open. Jake has nowhere to go, so he's either forcing passes. I think on the one pick that Adoree Jackson got to basically seal the game, I think he did have maybe Pettis open on that play. And
he did, but the game was over by that point.
It wasn't 100% over, but that was the only time the entire game where I looked down there and said, Jake missed that throw, yeah. Right? So you can't blame Jake completely because there was no separation. But the thing that really stood out to me was, if you think back to the game, right, a couple weeks ago, the Huskies go down against Utah deep in the game. And what do they do immediately after that?
I don't know.
They run the ball.
Okay. Yes.
They give it to LaVon Coleman. They give it to Miles Gaskin. They actually scored quicker than you would expect when they're running the ball.
Yes.
But they run the ball. And in this game, just gave up on the run so early and so completely. And I think maybe forgot that LaVon Coleman's on the team. I mean, how do you...
I mean, Coleman was out there. He was playing. It was just when they were in passing situations.
Right.
I mean, I think a lot of it was...
Your best running back is playing in a passing situation?
USC loaded the box and dared them to win one-on-one against their defensive backs, and UW's receivers weren't able to do it, which is a reminder that it was like 8 short months ago that Coach Pete fired the wide receivers coach, was talking about bringing in guys to play right away in the receiving core. Like, there was a lot of concern.
John
clearly.
Ross is still awesome, though. Let's just give it to John Ross, right? Because even in this horrible game, he still had 8 catches for 154 yards.
He did. That is very true. Pettis, surprisingly, was not able to win one-on-one. I think that was the bigger surprise. And Chico McClatcher.
It's not even about that, though, right? You look at these Seahawks receivers. Okay, Doug Baldwin's like clearly an elite level receiver. Jimmy Graham's, I'm talking myself out of this point.
But yeah, I know what you're saying. Because even when Jimmy Graham wasn't here, even when Doug Baldwin wasn't playing at this elite level,
no matter who you're playing.
But just, they can't script it because it's improvised. But they work on that so much with Russell Wilson that they have developed that skill to know where they're going to go, read him in the pocket.
And I would have told you before yesterday that the Huskies would have been in the same boat. But there's no reason why LaVon Coleman, who was averaging, probably still, because he didn't hurt his yards per carry that much, but should only have 2 carries in this game. That's insane.
Yeah.
And in a game, the Huskies weren't down by that much when they abandoned the run. I mean, Miles Gaskin's at 15 carries for 51 yards, which
I basically always want the Huskies to abandon the run.
In this scenario, too?
No, I guess I always want the Seahawks to abandon the run.
15 carries for 51 yards for Miles Gaskin is not that bad. It's not like he had 15 carries.
3.4 yards per carry?
It could have been 15 for 20. You've seen Todd Gurley's stat lines before. It could have been 15 for like 31.
So your suggestion is that the Huskies should play more like the LA Rams. That's your proposition.
I'm saying that it's better than the worst case scenario, which is the LA Rams.
Okay.
But it's not like they stuff their run that much. Let's say you run and get 3 yards. Then you're in 3rd and 4, and it's a little bit more appealing.
I suppose.
I just did not like abandoning. They were getting such good pass rush, right? And receivers weren't getting open. Why do you want to pass more? In the hopes that you get one lucky pass to John Ross?
Let me say, if you were worried that the departure of Jeff Tedford was going to completely change the Huskies offensively, this did not, even though he was on the sidelines apparently on Saturday,
this is the time to panic.
Yes. But can I come back to why I am rationalizing this above and beyond the loss of the rest of everyone else?
that should be the tagline for the Pelton cast. Why I am rationalizing
I'm rationalizing Husky basketball too. We'll get to that. Think about it. Before this season, if you would have told us, hey, in after week 10, the Huskies are going to be 9-1. They're going to be able to win the Pac-12 if they win out. And they'll have beaten Oregon by 49 points at staff that string. Yes. Like, is there anyone who would be like, oh, no, that sounds awful. Don't want any part of that. No, you'd be like, sign me up. That's amazing.
I don't think
that's where I am with
Huskies haven't been good enough for long enough to suffer from expectations.
Exactly.
No, I totally agree with you. That's why, like I said, we don't know how to react to this. We're still not that. This is what we come back to all the time. We're still not that far from removed from an 0-12 season.
We're not going to let go of that one for a long time.
We were there, right?
It should make us happy with anything.
Yeah.
There's nothing better than gratitude.
Honestly, like, let's say that the Huskies go to a very good bowl game, right? Maybe they finish the season with 2, maybe 3 losses. We can handle that.
Yep.
If they get to 10 wins and have 2, and they would be 10-3.
Yeah.
Be okay.
I mean, it'd be tough to watch the Cougs play in the Rose Bowl in that scenario, but, you know, what are you going to do?
And also, we can rationalize it because this is still a very young team, right? Jake Browning's only a sophomore. Miles Gaskin is only a sophomore. The best is not necessarily happening on the field right now.
So speaking of young teams.
Oh, God.
We come to Husky basketball.
I feel like we called this one, too. We didn't call it percentage chances of victory once, but we knew.
Yeah, I mean, we talked on this podcast about the Huskies' history of bad losses to mid-major teams at home. I think I did not call this because I was very cocky about this game. I gave them like an 85 to 90% chance of winning. Because I just thought Yale couldn't do anything without Mekhi Mason. And
everybody knows it's all about the system with Yale.
Credit to James Jones.
Is that their coach?
The most prominent sporting James
Jones.
The
Miami Heat player, right?
No.
Cleveland Cavaliers.
The most prominent sporting James Jones is the Yale basketball head coach. And he wears
a hoodie, right, when he plays?
Yes, when he coaches. He got his guys playing shortly after the loss of their leader, the engine of their offense, all of that. And Yale came into UW and had 7 turnovers against a team that was dramatically more athletic and more talented and, you know, just physically superior in every way, which did translate itself.
Pretty much the Romar era.
The Huskies having 15 blocks in this game. Yale had none. As Ken Pomeroy noted on Twitter, teams that had done that on average had won by 22 points dating back.
Ken Pom tweeted that? I thought you had come up with that stat on your
own. I was looking at it on Sports Reference. He actually had a more robust database that he could take a look at because he's Ken Pomeroy. And he was actually at the game.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Ken Pom's here?
He was.
What was it? Did he go to Yale?
No.
What's he doing here?
He has some friends who work with the UW coaching staff.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, no wonder he would tweet such a biased thing. Not necessarily. No, but just like understanding how unlikely it was for the Huskies to lose this game.
I mean, this is a weird game. The Huskies shot 59% in this game. They held Yale to 47% shooting. Like, in every sense, you should feel good about that. But Yale won this game because, first off, they attempted 15 more shots than the Huskies. They grabbed...
Because they just caught all of the blocks that we had.
They did. They grabbed about 45% of their offensive rebounds and held the Huskies to 16% offensive rebounding. And then, like I mentioned, the turnovers. The Huskies actually didn't have that many. They only had 13, but still fewer shots at the basket as a result. And that's why they were super efficient on offense. So it's an exceedingly odd game, and I'm really not sure ultimately how much to take from it long term, except that the Huskies have major issues defending the pick and roll and on the defensive glass.
I mean, they're going to work on it. I think you could stop at the Huskies have major issues defending.
Yes, I just wanted to get into the specifics.
Because there are going to be a lot of problems. Do you know what, if we can take... At first, this was Silver Linings Weekend, right?
It was.
It was a sad cast, and it was Silver Linings Weekend, right? Now it's celebratory, we're drinking and toasting weekend. This does not help NCAA tournament-wise.
No.
That's the crazy thing, is like, they're going to be looking at this come March. Right? This could... I mean, if the Huskies are even a factor... This game is going to matter. But do you want to know one thing potentially come June that's going to matter?
How good Markelle Fultz is?
That he casually scored 30 points.
He completely took over down the stretch.
I looked at that and was like, Markelle's and on 11 of 17 shooting too.
And with 6 assists. Like, he's not a selfish player in any regard.
the defense isn't amazing, but this is his team.
My guy, Matisse Thybulle.
That's the other thing I was going to say, is your prediction about him being... You said he was the best NBA prospect on last year's team.
No, no, I didn't say that. Marquise Kress was a better NBA prospect than him. I said he was a better prospect than DeJounte Murray. Okay. That was my hot take.
I'm going to keep exaggerating this. I was like, you said he was the best NBA prospect in all of college basketball.
Said he was the best NBA prospect UW has ever produced. But he had 20 points tonight on 6 of 7 shooting, 3 of 4 from 3, and blocked 6 shots.
That's an amazing game for Matisse Thybulle. Good things are coming for Matisse Thybulle. I don't know about anything else. And Markelle Fultz. I think the rest of the team is maybe not so great.
Offensively, it wasn't a bad performance. Now, obviously, it was primarily about Thybulle and Fultz, but... You know, Noah Dickerson comes in with 12 points on 5 of 6 shooting off the bench. David Crisp was fine in his first start at point guard, 12 points on 12 shooting possessions, even though he couldn't get the 3 to go down. So I'm not at all concerned about the Huskies offensively. My concerns are 100% at the defensive end of the floor.
Yeah. Plus the Seahawks won. So this game's completely forgotten to history because they decided to play it more or less opposite the Seahawks.
That is true.
So there was no crowd there.
Any other closing thoughts here?
What a salvage to the weekend.
Really. Like, the timing was everything.
Just,
we've got so many days, because there's not a major UW sporting event until at least the Husky basketball plays again on men on, the Husky men play on again on Thursday. Until then, we'll just be just basking in the glory of this win at New England.
I mean, if you were to circle your calendar before the year, right, the one game that you wanted to win the most was the next game on the schedule. But also, the other game that you wanted to win the most is going at New England, right? A team who is so hated.
You know, it's interesting. This came up at the Bill Barnwell Show live taping. Like, who's a bigger rival for the Seahawks, the Patriots or the Steelers? To me, it's 100% the Steelers, but other people clearly disagree with this.
Oh, man. I secretly like the Steelers a little bit, and I hate the Patriots.
Yeah.
I hate everything about the Patriots. They're the one team. Do you remember when they got destroyed by the Chiefs on Monday Night Football a few years ago? Everybody remembers it.
Sunday Night Football.
They've been the best team ever since then.
Oh, no, that was Monday Night Football.
It was Monday Night Football. Yeah. They've been the best team in the league since
Yeah, people
that
started
moment.
Writing their, like, Brady is done stories the next day. That was so great.
That yep. was. Do you remember, like, me texting you such celebratory things in that moment?
I really don't.
I was widely misguided, but when. If the Steelers...
That's also a good name for a blog that we
widely
started.
Misguided. If the Steelers era, the Ben Roethlisberger era came to an end, it would fizzle out and I wouldn't care, right? But let's say that the Brady and Belichick era comes to an end in embarrassing fashion. I will take such joy in that, right? Even more joy than I take... It's like Jim Harbaugh leaves and the 49ers are pathetic. It's like, it was kind of fun having them as a rival.
You like Jim Harbaugh now?
I don't like Jim Harbaugh.
That's what I'm getting from that.
I don't like Jim Harbaugh now. Although, especially seeing him lose to Iowa last night was pretty nice. I do not like Jim Harbaugh now. But I don't like anything about the Patriots. I don't like them as a rival. If the Seahawks were to go to the Super Bowl this year, I would rather play any other team because I don't want the Patriots to have gone to the Super Bowl.
Wow. That is a hot take because people want the Patriots to be the opponent so that they can avenge that loss.
Oh, I do not want the Patriots as the opponent.
All right.
That means they would have had to advance there, and the people of New England would be happy again, right? They don't need to go to the Super Bowl and have another chance.
I really did not see this coming at the end of this podcast.
You didn't?
I opened the door to it.
During the game, you were saying that I became a Seahawks homer, right? You actually said Sunday Night Football makes me a Seahawks homer.
I did say that, but I guess it's the Patriots?
It's the Patriot hate. I hate the Patriots every single second. Even when Tom Brady is my quarterback in fantasy, I hope that he gets injured so I can start Matt Ryan.
As you know, because of the fact that I follow the win forever philosophy so devotedly, I love my opponents because they help bring out the best in the Seahawks.
I'm sure that's what Pete Carroll will say about them too. He probably loves Bill Belichick.
I don't think that Pete Carroll's issues with the New England Patriots have that much to do with Bill Belichick.
He's probably a big.
I think it's
big,
the guy who fired him.
Big Robert Kraft guy.
But you know what? I think he's buried the hatchet. I think he's
tonight,
happy where he is.
Tonight we can bury the hatchet.
So on that note.
We'll be back later in the week. This is just a weekend review, right?
Yeah.
So we'll be back later in the week.
An appetizer for the entree that will be the regularly scheduled Peltoncast later this week.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.